understand. We brought this bill of review case after my client, Mr. Nussbaum, learned that there was a default judgment out of the 17th District Court here in Fort Worth in favor of Builders Bank on a guarantee agreement he had signed back in the early 2000 period. That judgment was entered in 2000, or the case was filed in 2006. And what's very interesting about this case, and really the most important fact you need to know, is that he was served under the Texas long-arm statute through the Texas Secretary of State. He is not a business. He is not required to maintain a registered agent for service of process. Under the Texas long-arm statute, if you're going to use that to serve an individual, you have to serve him at his home or home office address. And the party that is attempting service has the burden to provide the correct address, because the Texas Secretary of State doesn't have an address for an individual where there's no requirement that the individual provide one or keep a current address. In this case, Builders Bank provided an address that was in the guarantee documents that were signed 3 or 4 years before they filed suit. Well, that address was no longer good. The Texas Secretary of State forwarded the correspondence and the citation and the petition on to Mr. Nussbaum's old address. What's kind of an interesting fact in this case, although I'm not sure it matters too much, is that the Builders Bank's petition listed 94014, I believe, as the zip code, when the actual zip code is 92014. This problem was resolved when the Texas Secretary of State forwarded the correspondence on to my client's former address. It actually used the correct zip code. But to the extent that the inconsistency between the petition and the actual service papers are in conflict, I think, since strict compliance is required, that could be another basis for the court. But the bottom line is the correspondence never reached my client. It was returned. Forwarding order expired, undeliverable. The Whitney certificate that was filed in this case established that fact as a matter of law. And so we filed a bill of review after there was a default judgment entered. And really the two key points in the case are, what can the trial court do when you have a record on its face that shows that service was improper? Well, depending on who you believe, if it's bad enough, the court never really obtains jurisdiction over the defendant, so it has no power to enter any judgments against the defendant. And anything that the court does when service has not been affirmatively established, absent some waiver or appearance by the defendant, is void. And so,
does the fact that there's a forum selection clause in the guarantee impact that at all?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because the fact, we're not contesting that the state of Texas has jurisdiction over Mr. Nussbaum. We're not contesting that he was subject to suit here. All we're saying is, if you're going to sue him, you got to properly serve him. And there is no, I'm not even sure that, I guess there are waivers of service of citation, but those would happen after suit is filed, right?
Well, since the guarantee provided an address and also provided that a different address could be used for any notices required under the guarantee agreement, by updating and providing written notice on the other parties to the guarantee agreement of the new address, didn't your client actually contract to accept service at the address in the guarantee contract?
It's a good point, Justice Walker. What you're really saying is, if I'm hearing you correctly, and kind of what the trial judge, although he didn't get hung up on it too much, but the issue being, did he somehow agree that this is my service address? Did he create a situation where, just like with the Texas Secretary of State, he was required to maintain this address, and if he didn't, then he is out of luck if they try to serve him there? And the answer to your question is no, and because of the reason being that what you're really saying is, was he negligent? Was it his fault that he didn't get properly served? And because they didn't properly serve him, he's not required to meet that burden. Under our Texas state law and under our rules of procedure in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, there is no provision that I'm aware of that says service is proper at an address designated in a contract.
Well, I think there is law. It's just in other areas, for example, in insurance contracts and situations like that, where a party has a duty, the contracting party has a duty to keep the other party notified of their proper address for purposes of service or notice under the contract. So I think there is law, it's just hasn't been applied in this situation.
No, and I think there's good reason for not applying it in this situation. I mean, think about the confusion and the burden it would place on individuals to make sure that every contract that they've signed, that they could be subject to service of process at an old address. Especially
well,
in a situation.
But at the same time, a person's not going to forget that they've guaranteed $4 million. It's not like it was a $200 situation and they forgot, oh, I signed that guarantee and I don't need to provide updated notice. I mean, it's a situation where with that amount of money and when you have that address in the contract, why shouldn't we extend the campus investments versus Culver case to cover this situation?
The reasoning being, Your Honor, is that if you extend it this far, and the one fact that's being lost here is he clearly wasn't served. Not only was the forwarding order expired, the mail was returned. It never reached even the destination that was on the citation. And so if you extend, basically create a legal duty in a private contract situation, I think it's trouble. He's an individual. In his affidavit and all the evidence that we submitted, we showed that he did actually provide notice to the bank of his new address, but that he's lived in the same house forever, that he's had the same office number forever, that he's had the same email address forever, that if they wanted to find him, they could have found him. This isn't a situation where we have a defunct company that is unreachable, unfindable. This is an individual who should not be held to a $4 million default judgment because he never received the papers because the bank chose to serve him through the Texas Secretary of State under our long-arm statute.
Well, there's really not a dispute that he received the papers. He just was not served with the papers.
There is a dispute.
The guarantee agreement also provides for notice to an individual at the Dallas office of, is it BCN?
BNC, yes.
BNC.
Yes. Walker, you're right. But they never attempted to serve that entity. They sent
a
demand letter, I believe, to that entity. But they never served that address with the papers.
So you're saying the actual petition
right.
was not mailed?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And that's another point that we bring up in the papers. But I understand the conflict, right? I mean, it does make sense. You want to be able to hold people to their contracts. But in a case where we're talking about the fundamental due process right of protecting your interest in court, it just seems almost too far of an extension to require a defendant who's being sued and doesn't get the papers that you can hold him liable under the reasoning in the campus investments. There is no legal duty involved in that case, and that case deals with businesses who have, there is no individual that you can go and hand papers to. This is an individual who you can go find. We do it all the time. Why they chose the Texas Secretary of State, I don't know. But because they did, they had to meet certain burdens, and one of them was to show that he actually was served in the manner that they stated in there, and because it was returned, we've conclusively proven that he was not. And which just leads me quickly to my second point, which if you buy the first argument, which I think under the law and under the cases we cited, one out of this court, their main response argument is, well, he was negligent for the reasons that Justice Walker is reminding us of today, that he should have updated his address to the extent he didn't with Builders Bank. But if you reach number one and you find in our favor, then number two becomes irrelevant under Texas Supreme Court law. Because it's a due process concern, the judgment itself is void, so a bill of review plaintiff is relieved of the burden of showing that the failure to answer was not the result of his own negligence or fault. And then finally, the last real point is assuming that you don't buy either of the first 2 points, we're on a summary judgment stage. We submitted evidence that we did notify Builders Bank of our new address, and other mitigating factors like the fact that his home address is the same, his cell number is the same, things like that, and that he had no knowledge that the suit had been filed. But the Judge Lowe still granted summary judgment. So I think at the very least, if you don't buy anything I've said today, there is at least a fact issue of whether or not Mr. Nussbaum's failure to answer was the result of his own negligence. I don't think as a matter of law, there's enough evidence to show that as a matter of law, they've conclusively proven that element or defeated that element of our claim. So that's pretty much all I have. So I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pilavosan.
May it please the court. My name is Richard Grossman. I represent Builders Bank. Let me first alert the court to a mistake that I made in the briefs. Page 3, there's a paragraph in which it is stated that Nussbaum has employees at the Dallas address of BNC Real Estate. One of those employees is a person by the name of Laura Gambay. That is incorrect. I apologize. Laura Gambay worked in the Solana Beach office in California, which was in fact where Mr. Nussbaum had an office, and we demonstrate that in fact Ms. Gambay obviously got those papers. She signed for them. There's a Federal Express receipt that's a part of the record here. So I wanted to alert the court to that, Really, it should have said Nussbaum has employees at the California office, not the Dallas office. Secondly, I wanted to point out something that is in the record at page 613. You can go back and look at it. This case is about due process, it appears. Counsel's insisting that his client's entitled to due process, and that not being served deprives him of the opportunity to appear and defend. And on page 613 of the record, there's the copy of the relevant paragraphs of the guarantee. And paragraph 18, which hasn't been much talked about by either party, says that the guarantor waives personal service of process and agrees that all such service or process may be made by registered mail directed to the guarantor at the address stated herein. And the address stated herein is the one that appears just above, and it's the address, the 2775 Via della Vel address in Del Mar, California, where we sent everything. So, and I think it's worth talking about due process in this case, because as I point out in the briefs, the Texas Supreme Court, when they look at these kinds of situations, they ask the question, why didn't the person appear? If the answer is, I never got the papers, I didn't know anything, I never got anything, then usually the default will be set aside. But if the answer is, I got papers and then, as I've cited in that case, and the question is, did he ignore something? And if that's the case, then it seems that the burden would have been on him to do something. Now, we show that Mrs. Gambay, who was an employee of Mr. Nussbaum, received a document which I believe was an injunction and a temporary restraining order. And it listed the case number, the case name, the location of the case, everything that anyone would need to know, and would expect that if they got that paper, they would, after all, as Justice Walker's pointed out, this is a $4 million matter, they would call their attorney and they would say, wow, I just received this thing, what's going on? You know, I had no notice of it before, let's assume that's true. And by the way, I hadn't encountered this argument before counsel made it just now, but there's no dispute, I think, that each time we served at the Del Mar, California address, we sent it to Jesse Villarreal in the Dallas office. I think that's in the depositions. And he said he had no reason to believe that Jesse Villarreal, whoever that is, I assume that's some employee at his Dallas office, got those papers. So,
did you serve through the Secretary of State when you sent it to the other fellow in Dallas, Jesse?
No, I believe that was is in accordance with the guarantee. We sent it to him by mail or overnight express. And if you look at paragraph 17, it says all notices, communications, and waivers under this guarantee shall be in writing and shall be delivered in person or mailed, postage prepaid, either by registered or certified mail.
So your entire argument hinges on the fact that you think that the contract gives you a different standard for service than the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure and the Civil Practices and Remedies Code.
Well, you know, in the
because you couldn't have done that if you just applied the rules. You can't just mail it to somebody who happens to work in their office, and that's effective service.
Justice Sirth, I
unless you had a 103 order, a 106 order.
Right, and there was no 106 order in here. But I encountered an argument in the reply brief, which I hadn't seen before, which is that he wasn't required to maintain any kind of registered agent with Texas, but I believe the Texas Civil Procedure and Remedies Code 1744 says that if a person is a non-resident and the case develops after the person is a non-resident, you can use the Secretary of State to serve the process.
Yeah, but you didn't use the Secretary. That was my question. You didn't use the Secretary of State when you sent it to this other fellow that you're talking about.
No, that was just an extra.
Right. That's not service of process.
No.
That won't satisfy due process. That alone would not satisfy due process.
That's
so why does it matter? Why is that relevant?
It matters because, as I'm suggesting, the question, the essence of the case really is, what has this person been deprived of? They've been deprived of due process. That means that they've been deprived, in my estimation, of a meaningful opportunity to appear and defend himself. But if not only do we show that Mrs. Gambay got it, and not only is there no dispute that Mr. Villarreal got it, then really what's going on here is that, okay, so he figures maybe they haven't complied with the statute, and so I'm not going to do anything, and I'll delay that way, because maybe he has no defense, or he just doesn't want to appear. But what I'm suggesting is that he had plenty of notice, and
he just wasn't served.
Well, he wasn't served, but we get to the law on the subject, and I guess I'll turn to that, because their main defense, as I understand it, is that they rely on Wilson versus Dunn and Caldwell versus Barnes, which seem to say, or would say, that if you have a situation where you prove that he wasn't served in strict compliance with the law, then he's relieved of the obligation to prove any of those factors that we normally rely on. There's three of them. And campus investigations is, in my estimation, the exception, and should be applied here, because clearly these documents anticipate that they would give us an address, and it specifically says that they're going to. They can give us some other written notice.
What about his argument that they did provide you with an updated address?
Well, to the extent that there's a conflict in the affidavit of the post-deposition affidavit of Mr. Nussbaum and the affidavit of the chairman of Builders Bank, I say that conflict is resolved because, as I point out, I think I don't exactly know how to pronounce it, the Farou case, in which the court said, you, Faru versus Denny's Restaurants, you can't, a party cannot file an affidavit to contradict his own deposition testimony without any explanation for the change. And if it does, the affidavit must explain, in other words, does change it, they have to explain it. And without such, we assume that the sole purpose of the affidavit was to avoid summary judgment. Now, in this case, he had a deposition in which he said, I don't remember telling the bank that I had my a change of address. And then he files an affidavit after somebody files a motion for summary judgment. I did tell him. Well, there's no explanation of why what the difference is for his deposition testimonies compared to his post-deposition affidavit. So, and the, in that case, in the Faru case, they rejected the affidavit as just a post hoc sham to avoid summary judgment. But what I wanted to, the point I wanted to make was that if counsel, I don't see how counsel's cases can be right, and yet Campus is good law, and no one suggested that it isn't, because you don't get to Campus if you're irrevocably foreclosed from having to prove that you got service. How does Campus survive if that's actually the law? I don't see how you get there. So the Supreme Court, and of course Campus postdates all these other cases. So the Supreme Court in Campus says, well, we're looking at it and we say there's some evidence that the judge below could rely on to say that the man was negligent. He didn't update his address. And as Justice Walker points out, it's pretty clear when you look at the documents that he had the obligation to do so. It gives them the, or any other address as to any of the parties here to, as such party shall designate in a written notice. Well, why would there be a provision for designating another address in writing? That's because people move, and everybody knows that. So reasonable businessmen making contracts say, I'm going to be able to, we're making this agreement now, but if I move, I'm going to be able to tell you to serve me at a different address. But if you don't give me a different address, this is presumed to be the address. And it says in paragraph 18, they agree that all such service may be made at the address stated herein. So I believe that he has contractually obligated himself to either notify us that there's a new address, or that he, for whatever reason, even if he moves, he's agreed that that's the address that we can serve him at. And so we're suggesting that the law here supports our claim that they failed to satisfy the tripartite test for bill of review because the failure to receive the process was at least partly his negligence. And factually, it seems that he had, there's really incontrovertible proof that he actually got notice, which would have, he as a matter of fact admitted in his deposition that if I had received the document that was sent to Mrs. Gambe, I would have been served. That question was asked and answered in the affirmative by Mr. Nussbaum. So that even Mr. Nussbaum admits that if he got those papers, he would, misquote, maybe not have been served, but he would have been aware that he had been sued.
But isn't the case law pretty overwhelming that actual notice even doesn't matter? It's all about whether or not you were served with process?
There are cases that say that you must be served according to strict compliance, but in a case where A, he's in the document waived personal service. I mean, this is
right,
in the document.
I agree. That's a different issue. If you've waived service, you've waived service. But I don't agree that notice will substitute for service, that actual notice can somehow excuse service.
I I would not make that claim.
Okay.
In a just a normal case that just because and their citation to Wilson versus.
We have about a minute or two.
Right. That Wilson versus Dunn forecloses that is correct, as a general proposition. But of course, Campus is there to say, well, yeah, but you have to update the record.
But isn't Campus currently? I mean, you're asking us to extend Campus because right now the Campus Investments versus Culver case is limited to where a party has a secretary. I mean, I'm sorry, a party has a registered agent address on file with the Secretary of State, and then because they've agreed that they can be served through the Secretary of State on their registered agent, that is where the duty to update comes from. So saying that a duty to update comes from a contract would be an extension of Campus.
There hasn't been a case like that, but I would urge the court to take into consideration that really what we're talking about here is due process. The only reason, well, apparently my time, if I can finish that sentence, the only reason that we used the Secretary of State was because we believed that there was sufficient reason to believe that he could be served through the Secretary of State. And once you give the Secretary of State that address, what difference does it make if the Secretary of State had an address on file with a registered agent or if we gave him the address, as long as it's the correct address? I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Grossman. Mr. Pilavosian.
Thank you. I just wanted to address some of the points, and I'll forgive Mr. Summers for some of the inaccuracies. He wasn't the lawyer handling this at the trial court, but a couple of things he said were inaccurate. One, I wanted to make absolutely clear that what Builders Bank sent to Mr. Villarreal in Dallas was not the suit papers. What was sent to him was a demand letter. The papers that were sent to Ms. Gambe in California was not the lawsuit. It was a TRO that was entered in the lawsuit.
Was it an application for TRO or was it the TRO?
It was the actual order.
Okay.
And what Mr. Nussbaum testified to in his deposition was that, hey, yeah, if Ms. Gambe got this, her normal course would be to forward it on to me. I never got it. I don't know what happened in this case, but I've never seen this before. That's what the testimony was. And I have to address this post-affidavit, post-deposition. What happened in this case is we filed a motion for summary judgment because we felt the evidence was pretty strong that we weren't properly served. So we did that relatively early. Opposing counsel asked for Mr. Nussbaum's deposition. We argued against it, saying, hey, it's just look at the record. The record shows that it wasn't properly served. There's no need for a deposition. The court granted a deposition. The affidavit that was filed was actually filed before the deposition took place. And what's in his deposition came second. So to the extent that there's a conflict between the two, I guess what's in his deposition should be stricken versus what's in his affidavit. And the final point I want to make, which is
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
So you're saying that in his affidavit, he said, I didn't get it.
Correct.
Oh, no, I sent it.
This is the updating of the address. Yes. He said that
I sent them an update.
Right.
And then his affidavit, he says, I don't remember doing that.
No, in his affidavit,
and then in his deposition, he says, I don't remember doing that.
I'll have to take them at their word. I don't remember what he said in his deposition. But assuming it's a conflict, then, that would be a conflict. But I don't remember that point. So I don't want to represent that they're inaccurate on that. We'll just have to go back to the record and make sure. The other point I wanted to make was, and this goes back to Justice Walker's poignant points, they didn't say in their petition, we're serving Barry Nussbaum pursuant to our contract, or we're serving him pursuant to our guarantee agreement, which says that he's waived, and it's very clear, it's not that he waives service. If that were the case, then I guess they could just sue him and get a default judgment when he doesn't show up, right, without giving him a citation. He's waived personal service, somebody handing it to him in person. To me, that's kind of neither here nor there, because it's fine to serve somebody through the certified mail and under our rules, and that's what happened. What they did, though, is they said, we are serving Barry Nussbaum through the Texas long-arm statute, through the Texas Secretary of State, because he does business here. They chose that avenue. If they were going to rely on some contractual argument, they should have put that in their petition, but they didn't. And because they didn't, because they chose the long-arm statute, what Justice Walker keeps reminding us of is that under our rules of procedure, it is prima facie proper service to serve the registered agent at the registered office. If you have the wrong registered agent and you got the wrong registered office, that's your problem. But that is proper service on its face. As long as those match up, as far as the Texas Secretary of State records and your petition, you've got proper service on your face. What they want you to say is, yeah, I know that's the law. We should extend that to, hey, if I've got a contract out here that has an address on it that I say you haven't updated, that's good enough. That's good enough. And I'm telling you, and I'm arguing to you that that would be such an extension. It would create such a inequity, I believe, especially when you're dealing with banks and individuals.
But why? Why can't parties contract for a particular address to be the address that they will consider to be the address for proper service unless they update it? I mean, parties can contract for everything else, including contractual waiver of jury trials, including all types of due process issues. So why can't they contract for this?
I guess the answer to that is because even though parties can contract to things, there still has to be a system of due process where you can say and look in a record and go, okay, I know this person was properly served. I've looked at the record, and I know this person's
but
been properly
he
served.
He was properly served at the address that was in the notice.
But
I
if
mean,
somebody
were
to go back and look at the record, they wouldn't know that. All they would know
they would
is
know that. There's the Whitney certificate from the Secretary of State that shows that the original petition and the first amended petition was mailed by the Secretary of State to the address provided in the guarantee agreement.
Well, that's not what it says. It says it was forwarded and returned for unable to forward, and that's not how they chose to serve him. And this is really clear, Justice Walker, that I think you've got to remember in this case, just because that address was a good address at one time, because they've chosen this avenue to serve this individual, they've got to show that it's a good address, regardless of whether or not we had some obligation to update them with the address. Because they chose this method, which I believe is a method that was utilized to maybe not give him notice, it's their burden to prove proper service. And I just can't stress that enough. This is not a case where we're dealing with a corporation dealing with an individual. And the law is pretty clear. If it's not shown that he actually was served in the manner that is set forth in the petition, it's not valid service.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pilibosen and Mr. Grossman. We appreciate you all being here today, and we appreciate all of your briefing as well as your arguments. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused. We will now take a recess until our 10:30 docket.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in recess.